Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
South Africa, like Canada, like most of the world, is dominated by capital-centered interests. And those interests, which are always to make the maximum rate of profit, are at the expense of the workers who produce the wealth that goes into those profits.
That's the voice of journalist Charles Borland. On this week's show, we speak to Charles about the terrible massacre of striking miners in South Africa and how we need to move to a more human-focused society and not capital-focused. Stay tuned.
Someone who has been reporting on the many struggles that the workers of the world engage in is my next guest. Charles Borland is a journalist. He is the host and producer of Discussions, a show on Co-op Radio every Wednesday night. We're very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you very much for joining us, Charles.
Hi, Sylvia. Thanks for having me again. It's a pleasure. Yeah, good morning to you and to your listeners. And obviously, this morning, it's a very tragic occasion that the South African state, acting on behalf of the wealthy Anglo and American finance capitalists in the mining industry, massacred 34 mine workers and wounded some 78 others in South Africa just on Thursday in the town of Marikana. The company, Lonmin, is the third largest platinum producer in the world. Last year, they laid off some 9,000 mine workers, and they apparently rehired most of them for waging a struggle, basically, Sylvia, to raise their standard of life that is in accordance with the wealth that they produce and the work that they do to produce that wealth of platinum from the earth there, in their very difficult mining work that they do. And in this slaughter of workers, one can only reflect back, as I can as a living person, remember the slaughter of the Sharpsville massacre that took place under the apartheid regime. What is remarkable about the two events, Sylvia, is that they were both conducted, the present massacre and the massacre in Sharpsville. Although the political framework and the political context is quite different, one with the white racist apartheid regime back in 1960, and today's South Africa, which has defeated apartheid through years and years of struggle. But both incidents reflect that South Africa, like Canada, like most of the world, is dominated by capital-centered interests. And those interests, which are always to make the maximum rate of profit, are at the expense of the workers who produce the wealth that goes into those profits. You know, it's a cautionary tale for British Columbians, for certain, because there are many aspects of this tragedy and of the struggle of the South African miners that ought to bring some thoughtfulness to us as we discuss and debate the direction of the economy in BC. And I'll come back to that in a minute, but first, if you don't mind, Sylvia, I'd like to just say a little bit more about the situation in South Africa. The workers there are currently making about $480 to $600 a month. They're struggling to increase that salary to a living wage to around $1,500 a month. It's almost double that they're asking for. But the problem that the mine corporations face is that when you rely on the production and export of base metals or any basic raw material, you're always dependent on the fluctuation of the market, of the world market. Platinum, as you well know, is used primarily as a catalyst converter in automobiles to convert the gases to carbon dioxide and the nitrogen gases to nitrous oxide and so on. Secondly, it's used in jewelry, and it's used in a whole lot of other electronic industries and so on. But the world demand for that has fallen of late. And so there's a downward pressure on the price. And so a mining monopoly like this British imperialist company, by the way, it began in the turn of the 20th century as a straightforward London Rhodesia named mining corporation. It's gone up and down in its history, but it's always been a capital-centered, profit-oriented, based on the super-exploitation of the workers and the exploitation, of course, of Mother Earth. So we need, in my opinion, Sylvia, from the point of view of British Columbians, we need to look at the experience. Of course, the situation in South Africa is, you could say, oh, well, it's not the same here in British Columbia. Of course, it's not the same. But there are elements that ought to make us reflective about what we're doing in terms of what the premier of the province, British Columbia, calls a job plan for British Columbia. And it one of the pillars of that new development, that strategy that she has, is to turn over huge tracts of British Columbia territory for the exploitation by giant mining monopolies. Now, the largest platinum monopoly in South Africa, as I mentioned, is the Anglo-American Platinum Mining Company. And one of the features of its present situation is that it has been viciously attacking the indigenous peoples, the indigenous tribes, living near the mine sites where the Anglo-American Mining Company exists. They launched a slap suit against a lawyer in South Africa to prevent him from bringing attention to the dislocation and disruption of the villages that this mining development would bring about. Now, if you come back to British Columbia, what do we see here? We see here the imposition of mining companies in a place like the Prosperity Mine on the land of the Tsilhqot'in people. We see the development of a huge mining potential operation up in northwest British Columbia, on another indigenous people's land there, in a very, very beautiful piece of British Columbia geography. So these mines are subject to the rise and fall of the base metal prices. They produce very small mining communities, and there's no processing of the ores or the base metals. In the case of petroleum, which they're going to want to bring across in pipelines, the same thing. There's no plan for the development of a sustainable economy that will produce stable communities, stable, good-paying jobs, and help build a kind of Canada that the people would like to create. What kind of world will predominate? Will it be an ongoing imposition of this capital-dominated world where everything is summed up and evaluated in terms of investors' returns, investment dollars going to coupon clippers God knows where around the world, mostly in the Anglo-American world, the advanced, you know, the big wealthy countries. These are where the billionaires mostly live. But the essence of the company remains the same as when it was existing in apartheid times. And it's the same with the big corporations in North America. It's the same kind of capital-centered outlook that brings about ruination to nature. It brings about instability and economic insecurity for working-class people. And it does nothing to build the nations. Now, there's a youth leader in South Africa who I've just been reading about. His name is Julius Malema, former African National Congress Youth League leader. He was expelled from the ANC just recently, and there's apparently a big political battle going on there, no doubt about it. But he gave the call, you see, to nationalize the mines of South Africa. To my way of thinking, that's a positive political stand to take, because the resources belong to the people. And so the people need to have the mechanisms of political power that allow them to discuss and plan and debate how to use these precious natural resources to create a human-centered world. Not a capital-centered world, but a human-centered world. A world in which the rights of every human being, by virtue of the fact that they're a human being, they have rights, rights to housing, rights to a livelihood, as you said earlier, to clean water, to air, to food. These are the things human beings need to flourish and to maintain their dignity and live a proper life. So these are the big questions that face us vis-a-vis the BC economy. Do we want a British Columbia that is producing these base metals, transporting bitumen across its beautiful territory, taking great risks? Do we want to just export raw logs? Or do we want to build an economy in British Columbia that provides stable communities, lifts the standard of life, provides the resources necessary to make the school system, the public education system, what it used to be and even better, to lift the debt load off our post-secondary students, our young generation seeking to get a proper training and education, to look after the old people, to ensure that all the senior citizens have decent housing? These are the issues that confront us. And if we don't look at these tragedies like what took place in South Africa and reflect on our own situation and actively participate in saying no to this whole direction of capital-centered imposition of resource extraction in British Columbia, we will go down. We will become a place that is less secure and more environmentally disrupted.
The repercussions of mining companies is well known in Latin America, where genocide and displacement is the day-to-day reality of indigenous people who are Mayan, the Incas, you know, great civilizations that are being destroyed today by the interests of mining companies, most of them, you know, here in BC. So let's talk a little bit about the implication of following a model of economics, you know, the neoliberal model of economics, that instead of recognizing the failures of capitalism as a system that's a capital-centered rather than people-centered economy model, has entrenched the rights of the 1%, you know, and not only entrenched, but also now controls many of the levers of government in terms of the slap suit that you spoke of, you know, the slap suits that have been imposed on Indigenous people here in Canada, the Algonquin conflict recently, where a grandmother was put in jail for protecting the nesting grounds of an owl from a mining company in Indigenous territory that's supposed to be protected. So can you talk about the connection there? And because that leads us to where we're going, where, you know, we are constantly being told by governments, this is our economic plan. Just because they declare that that's the way they want to go, that doesn't mean that is legitimate or that is based on what is needed for the province.
Well, I think, Sylvia, that's very important. A point that you're making, that it is people themselves, communities themselves, that need to find the ways and means of discussing what are possibilities for themselves without simply turning over their resources to the so-called foreign investors. You see, the predominant dogma in British Columbia is that we have to attract investment. What does attracting investment mean? It means that the citizenry of British Columbia will provide for subsidies for foreign capitalists to come and extract our resources, make a large profit on them, and then leave. Not only leave, but leave the mess behind to be cleaned up again by the citizens of British Columbia. And we have a long record of that in the mining industry. You can just go up to Britannia mine, the old Britannia mine, which used to be the largest copper mine in the British Empire, used to brag about at the early 20th century. And we are still processing the waste products flowing out of that mine. And it did tremendous pollution damage. The people of British Columbia had to pick up the bill for that, basically. And we have many other examples of ghost towns in BC right across the province. Now we have proposals for 8 or so new mines in the province, and the enlargement of several other mines. Now, mining is essential human activity. There's no question about it. You need to extract certain resources from the earth, but the question is how to do it, how to use it, who to make it serve. So the whole motivation for mining, as in any other economic activity, has to be decided around who does it serve, whose interests. Will it be used, like you take, for example, a mine that they're proposing in Fish Lake. The people in that area, they need to be the deciding factor in that. They need to decide whether that project is going to be environmentally disastrous, which was the conclusion of the first government inquiry into that, the environmental assessment. And they have to be the deciding factor as to if it's going to be developed, and if it is going to be developed, you know, how will the wealth of that be used? Now, in the particular case I'm mentioning, this Prosperity Mine project, the indigenous population who have unceded rights, it's their home territory, it belongs to them, they need to have the decisive say. And they need to work with the non-indigenous population to say, well, how are we going to lift the economy in this Williams Lake plateau area of the province? How are we going to provide a livelihood? And then, of course, one of the key things we're going to have to look at is the future of the wood industry, which has been the backbone of the BC economy since the late 19th century. And then we have to face the fact that, okay, in the last 10 years, we've lost 32,000 direct production jobs. 2.5 other jobs per direct production jobs went down the tube with those. We have to look at the fact that the softwood lumber agreement was imposed on Canada, which blocks the so-called free trade between Canada and the United States of America and suits the big lumber monopolies in the United States as opposed to the medium and small producers in Canada. And we have to go step by step and look how to develop an economy in the Williams Lake area or in the Kitimat area, where they just shut down 2 years ago a very good pulp mill, Eurocan pulp mill. The West Fraser Company just shut it down and threw 500 workers out of a job in Kitimat. And then we have to say, well, is the alternative to that pulp mill, is it a good idea to bring in a natural gas pipeline and then liquefy that natural gas? Now, first they were saying, oh, BC Hydro will give them below-cost electricity to produce, and now they're having qualms about that, saying, oh, Jesus, maybe that's going to be too much of a bill to put on the taxpayers of BC or whatever. I don't know what has given them a qualm about that. But they've now opened a loophole where they can burn natural gas to turn electric turbines, to turn more natural gas into liquid natural gas, which they'll put in liquid natural gas carriers and take it over to Asia, and then de-liquefy the gas and burn it in. Now, Sylvia, you have to ask yourself, what's the logic here? What is the thinking here? This is Shell Oil and a number of other big multinationals talking about these kind of projects. But then you think, well, how is it that the Burrard Inlet gas thermal generator was shut down because it was not a green operation? And suddenly now it's becoming green to burn natural gas to drive electricity, electrical turbines, to liquefy more natural gas to export it. You see, it's all, why are they doing that? They're doing it because the price for natural gas in the Asian market is way higher than the price of natural gas in North America, which is at an all-time low because capitalism is in a huge economic crisis. The same reason the miners are being pressured in South Africa, because the platinum prices generally are being depressed because car production in the European Union is an all-time low, and therefore they don't need catalytic converters for cars, and therefore the demand on platinum has gone down. So you see, all of these interconnections in this so-called global market lead us to conclude that it's far more rational, it's far more beneficial to the people of each country to develop their economy in a rational way, collectively working out how to feed, clothe, shelter themselves, and build a cultured society, a humane, human-centered society, as much as possible, relying on their own resources and trading for mutual benefit with one another for those things that we don't have.
I just want to jump in because I think that that's a key point to our discussion. You know, the countries of the southern corner of Latin America have spoken about fair trade, not free trade. And
yes.
I think you've making a very good connection. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because nationalizing resources or recognizing that the resources of British Columbia ought to directly contribute to the well-being of the indigenous peoples of these territories, of the settler populations who inhabit in these communities, and that this need to be managed by the population in a fair and egalitarian way if we are to have economies that will be here seven generations from now. Can you speak to this?
Yeah, Sylvia, I think first off, a very important point you make is an acknowledgement by the people who have moved to British Columbia over the last 100 years to acknowledge the fact that colonialism, European colonialism, led by the British in this particular case of British Columbia, led to the extermination of very high numbers of indigenous populations. We have to acknowledge that there was a terrible genocide that took place here. Across British Columbia generally, they estimate between 90 and 95% of the populations of villages were wiped out in smallpox epidemics. So acknowledging that, the very first thing you would think that the population that lives here now would say is, okay, we need a reconciliation. We need a new basis of unity between those of us who are newcomers to this territory and the people who have lived here literally forever, and build a civilization here and learned how to live in harmony with nature at the level of production they had attained in their time here. So what would reconciliation be, Sylvia? It seems to me reconciliation would be, number one, eliminating the poverty that exists now in all the villages and homelands of these indigenous populations, where the youth, generally speaking, are forced off the land. Well, the mining company comes along and says, oh, well, we're going to help fix that. We're going to give these youth a crash 6-week course in mining, or a 10-week course in sheet metal or mechanical, and whatever. Because they're speaking quite openly that the labor force they need for these mines in these various places are going to come from the indigenous youth. Well, that may be okay for a small handful of those youth, but the fact of the matter is the mine is going to have a 25 or 20-year lifeline. That doesn't build a stable community. That doesn't build a stable economy. And, moreover, it won't see the lifting of the entire, indigenous population standard of life. There'll still be the mass migration into the city of Vancouver and so on. So, first off, we have to build an economy that will provide stable jobs, stable communities, and ensure that the indigenous people enjoy the fruits of that economy, find a livelihood and proper housing and so on, and rectify the old colonial legacy. Turn it around. That's number one. And then after that, Sylvia, working together to figure out how to build a sustainable, rational economy. Can human beings sit down together and plan how to build an economy? I don't think that's beyond our capabilities, is it? I watched them build the roof. There was a program last night on TV, Sylvia, quite interesting. And I have to say, I was deeply impressed with the skill of Canadian engineers and Canadian workers, steel workers, high iron, these high iron workers that go up high and pull these cables on, to build the roof on the stadium. But I'm thinking to myself, all that talent, all that pressurized work, they had to do it in 18 months, and they were working so hard to make sure, God knows, I hope nobody was killed in that process or injured on the job, but whatever. They did a fantastic job. You have to hand it to them. All tribute to these workers and engineers who built that magnificent project. Oh, magnificent what? A roof, a retractable roof on a football stadium. Jesus Christ, the people are, crying out for hospitals, for schools, for seniors' homes, for any number of things those workers could have built. So who decided that we're going to have a football stadium roof instead of those other things that $500 or $600 million could have built.
Because I think in part the struggle that we're in is to be able to define needs from wants, to be able to say, you know, this is necessary and this is optional. You know, a football field, well, although I love football and I'm a big fan, I don't think that it's necessary to spend billions of dollars building a roof for a field. You know,
well, I don't. It wasn't billions. It was about $600 million. But the thing is, you're right, Sylvia. It's a question of who decides. So you have a capital-centered world, people who have money invested in these big sports corporations, which are now threatening to lock out the NHL hockey players. I mean, you know, it's a very upside-down world. The world is completely upside down, a tiny little pinnacle of people with enormous wealth and control and politics, and they control the police forces. They can tell the police forces, shoot those bloody miners down. How does that work? How does it occur to a state organ to commit such terrible... They say, my life was threatened. Well, how did you get there in the first place being told to put these miners in their place? Who are you working for? Are you working for the miners and people of South Africa? Or are you a tool at the hands of the mining monopoly? And life has proved that they are a tool of the mining monopoly. So these are all real questions, you know. Who controls? Who decides? And that, to me, is the really central issue of our time.
You know, these are struggles that unites us, that ought to concern all of us, because ultimately, it's a story of, will we have a future? Will we have a collective future? Or will we allow a very small percentage of interest moneyed companies to determine who lives and who dies? And ultimately, I think that's the struggle we're in.
Yeah, I think you're dead on, Sylvia. The issue of who decides is central. It's a central political issue. Economically speaking, the issue is whether it's going to be human-centered or capital-centered in terms of the interests that it serves. And, you know, in terms of outlook, in terms of culture, also a very big issue. And that is whether we are going to look at everything from I-centeredness, you know, me, 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 which is how corporations have to look at the world, because they are faced with the law of the jungle they have themselves created, where the big fish eats the small fish. And so they're so I-centered. But then a modern outlook really has to start from the fact that we have a social economy. Everybody works collectively. These mines are huge collective operations where people from all sorts of trades and professions and workers of all different skills get together and produce a product. And so that's a social-centered, that's a societal-centered, collective-centered outlook that is very, very different in its content, in its quality, than this egocentric making money. It doesn't matter how I do it and who has to pay for it.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure, Sylvia, always. Take care.
Take care, Charles.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.